Chapter 9. John of the Antarctic. One January night in 1972, I lay languidly draped over the comfortable deep red Chesterfield. I listened to the tiny clangs as bubbles of carbon dioxide effervesced their way past my ear to burst at the top of a quadruple glass of gin and slimline tonic with ice but no lemon in. I relaxed in the sheer lack of austerity in this, the largest room in my penthouse in Belsize Park. Banks of spotlights focused harsh geometric slabs of magenta, emerald green and beige across the walls, while from a thurible effused frangipani, bergamot and chypre, compounding a mirantic furlough of didantalism. From some 43 feet away I could barely make out the distant drone of my brother, who is, after all, a surgeon, examining a friend of mine. This friend had an umbilical hernia I thought needed attention. His examination complete, my brother agreed, and we set about making the arrangement for his admission to hospital, when the telephone rang, and a voice said, "Is that Dr. Graham Chapman?" "Yes," I riposted. "Ah," said the voice, "you're just down as Chapman Dr. G in the book. I just wanted to check. I've got a young man staying with me who's quite ill. He's got a high fever, but he refuses to go to hospital or see my doctor. He says that he's met you. You gave him your autograph once. He says he would see you." "Who is that?" You wouldn't know if I told you, but it's Richard Milner." "You were right," I told the voice, "and that the best thing would be to wrap him up well and bring him round, as we seem to be holding a mini-surgery in my flat that evening anyway." Half an hour later he arrived, a good-looking young man, introducing himself as John Tomicek. I'd seen him outside a Kensington restaurant. The long dark hair, olive complexion, bright blue fur-lined jacket, and blue and maroon trousers jogged the memory. I showed him into the main room and took a brief history. He was 17 years old, from Liverpool, and in London, staying with a friend, while waiting to take up some sort of apprenticeship with a shoe firm. He'd had two similar attacks of fever at roughly monthly intervals, but this was the worst yet. He also complained of tiredness, general muscle pains, and headache. My brother examined him, and finding enlargement of the superficial lymph nodes, considered glandular fever, or infectious mononucleosis if you would prefer, though why you should I don't know, the most likely diagnosis. The fever at monthly intervals sounded more ominous, however, reminiscent of a Pell-Ebstein fever found in the more serious condition of Hodgkin's disease, a lymphadenoma if you'd prefer that. We decided immediate hospitalization would be wise, and with the aid of his efficaciousness, A.R. Bailey, physician, had him admitted to the Royal Northern Hospital for bed rest and the appropriate clinical tests. The tests confirmed the diagnosis of glandular fever and showed that he'd had a fairly severe infection which had affected his liver. 2 weeks later, the ambulance service rang me to say, "We've got a John Robert Tomicek here who's only given us your address. Since you had him admitted, where should we take him?" They actually sounded busier than that. "Bring him here," I said, thinking, "well, we can sort everything out between ourselves." John arrived, and certainly looked better, though still pale and weak. He was rather non-committal about this friend he'd been staying with, Richard Milner. I thought that rather than have him going off, popping into pubs, doing further damage to his liver, perhaps a short convalescence with us would be wise. We did have a spare room. I asked him about his family and background, but because of his strong Liverpool accent and an ability to feel less well whenever he was questioned, I let things ride, thinking, well, he'll tell us when he's ready. Meantime, we shall make sure he eats well and continues to recover. This proved difficult, and he only ate fish and chips and jam butties. But 4 weeks later, he had indeed recovered. I'd just finished an intense writing stint and thought that a weekend away would be a good idea. And so it was that David, Andrew, my Irish-Portuguese chauffeur, John and I set off to go to North Wales. I'd equipped all of them with climbing boots, anoraks, etc., and at last had a team who would come climbing with me. It was an uneventful journey, apart from a major accident when a 25-ton truck drove into the side of my Van den Plas Princess at 50 miles an hour. Fortunately, the car bore the blow pretty well, and we were able to continue our journey. There were two doors on the other side of the car, after all. Rather later than I'd hoped that night, we checked into the Penygwrydd Hotel at the foot of Mount Snowdon. It was February, and Snowdon can be a difficult proposition in the winter, but we were well equipped, ice axes, ropes, carabiners, space blankets, emergency rations, the lot. The next morning, when we set out from the Penny Pass, there were patches of blue in the sky and the air was crisp. Up above us, Crib Goch, the first peak in the Snowdon group we were about to climb, stood covered in cloud down to just about the snow line. We would have at least 1,000 feet of snow and ice to tackle before reaching its summit. From Crib Goch, I was hoping to complete half the Snowdon horseshoe by going on to the top of the highest peak and then to make our return to base coming down via the easy pig track. I think John was a little alarmed at the number of people he saw coming down having failed to get up. I was slightly apprehensive myself, but confident that there was nothing 4 young fit men couldn't take on. At one point there was a tricky little slab of rock covered with ice, which in the cloud gave the appearance of being steeper than it actually was. John was worried by this at first, but I lowered a rope to him to make sure that he got up safely. We very rarely needed to cut steps and made good time up to the summit itself. The ridge extending from Crib Goch to the main body of Snowdon is a narrow one, and in these conditions represented a knife edge of rock covered with ice. Steep snow slopes fell precipitously on either side, disappearing into the cloud below. It was appallingly cold, way below zero, and the wind tore at us, showering us with spicules of ice. Suddenly, everything went crimson, with little gussets of gamboge, but Evans knew what Scott was thinking. "That Ballyman Oates has been a pain in the neck ever since we hit Antarctica 9 months ago." The frost over Evans' eyebrows and icicles in his beard can't hide the fact, thought Scott, that Evans' lips, though green with cold, would, if they could, have said what he knew him to be thinking. Oates was a bore, an unmitigated, crushing bore. Whatever possessed them to accept such a fellow in the first place? "Well, he's nipped out for a moment for one of his boring little walks. He'll be back in a minute, screaming odes at us at the top of his voice over the howl of the wind." The two men stared at each other, then, acting like two men, crawled out and dismantled the tent, ran off, and piled it onto the back of the sledge. The sledge, covered with the bodies of the dead dogs whom they later intended to give a decent English burial, was heavy. But the thought of Oates quoting, "a thing of beauty is a," made them pull even harder, and they broke into a jog as the thought of Oates' premature return struck them both. Soon they were miles away, safely encamped again, making up stories about how brave Oates had been, walking out like that, saying, "I'm just going out for a walk," though really we both knew how he considered himself as a burden on us. Tee-hee-hee, they both thought, until they didn't. Almost as suddenly, everything went white, and we were progressing along the ridge, for safety in the high wind, quite often sitting astride it, with one leg hanging either side. We were getting along slowly, but safely, and I was thankful for the cloud. If any of the party had seen the drop on either side, they might have been as worried as I was. We came to the end of the first part of the ridge, and the going became easier, but I thought we'd better abandon our original plan and get down sooner. I was thinking of safety and the pub opening hours. I decided to take a more direct route down a gully to our left. To make a quicker descent, I unroped the whole team for the climb down the snow slope. John, thinking, "What a relief, it's all over, we're down the dangerous bit," leapt off ahead. I stopped him, and we all roped up again. I knew that steady progress was better than haste, because at the bottom of these couloirs, what in summer is a waterfall, in winter becomes a miniature glacier. Sure enough, when we got to the point where the waterfall should have been, there was an ice flow. I had to cut steps down it carefully. It took about 1.5 hours to get down the ice slope, but as soon as we were at the bottom of it, we were almost on the snow line, scattered patches of snow and rocks above a scree. On easier ground again, we unroped. We could actually see the pig track 300 feet or so below us. John again set off rather too quickly, and I shouted at him to slow down. Unfortunately, he had picked up so much momentum he couldn't stop, tripped and somersaulted about 35 feet down the mountainside. In the process, he cut his forehead and collected some chest abrasions and a possible fractured left leg. We climbed down to him and tried to carry him, but the pain from the leg was soon too much for him to bear. I stayed with him, wrapped him in space blankets and patched up his forehead with surgical tape, sending David and Andrew down with our map reference to get the mountain rescue team. The weather was too foul for the helicopter to fly, and so we had to wait for the RAF mountain rescue team to come on foot. Even though we were much lower down the mountain than we had been, it was still extremely cold, and by now darkness had fallen. A high wind and driving snow enhanced the sense of danger. I had a torch and a whistle, and began SOS signalling, but John and I had to wait there for 4 hours before any sign of rescue. Another party, loosely fitting our description, 2 men, 1 young with a broken leg, had fallen lower down the mountainside. The RAF picked them up and thought they'd rescued us. They hadn't. The team arrived back at base, and there waited an anxious David and Andrew. "It's okay, we've got them," said the RAF. David looked at the faces and said, "That's not Graham, and that's not John either." The RAF team set out again, with David showing the route of our descent. 4 hours at minus temperatures in the dark somewhere on a mountainside is a bit telling on the spirit and strength. John wasn't too bad, as some of the other climbers had stopped on their way down and provided extra blankets. I was worried. I continued blowing my whistle and flashing the torch at intervals, as you're supposed to, and waited for a return signal. Wonderful. I heard their whistle way below and to the left of us. I increased my blowing. A marvellous moment this, I heard a distant shout. They must have seen my light. I saw their light quickly return my flash. That was fan-bloody-tastic. All thoughts of what eternity smells like had vanished. They climbed up to us and gave me some hot soup as John was carefully strapped onto a tubular alloy mountain rescue stretcher. Then we had to lure him down the mountainside. Quite a big team is involved in these kind of operations. You have to have one person going down in front to work out the best route, a couple of bearers at the front of the stretcher, three on either side, and a team of about eight others hanging onto ropes behind so that the stretcher can be lowered down crags and cliffs. Being a non-injured party, I was naturally expected to help, and so took my place hanging onto the ropes at the back. I was so exhausted I couldn't help for long. My hands couldn't grip anymore, and I kept stumbling. The last 300 feet down were too much for me. I gave up and said, "Sorry, I can't help anymore," and slid down the rest of the way on my ass. I couldn't even walk. It was appalling. Once the stretcher party reached the footpath, they set off at a quicker pace. One of the RAF team stayed behind with me just to make sure I didn't stagger into the lake, which was almost exactly near 0°C as you can get without water actually being ice. The unfortunate thing was that what is normally a causeway across the lake, Lyn Padarn, in the winter isn't. It is 4 feet deep in ice-cold water, either side of which, should you step off, is 40 feet of ice-cold water, which isn't good for anyone's health. Either that, or you go round the lake, a 4-mile-long slog. I didn't want to go 4 miles, as opposed to 100 yards, neither did the man with me. But we had to cross that lake, guided only by the lights of the Land Rover on the other side. It was pitch black, and if we'd slipped off either side, we'd both have been dead, no doubt about that. We got across, up to the waist in my case, in ice-cold water, at the end of what had been a rather long day. David had by now crossed it 3 times. We arrived back at the Penygurith Hotel, and John was taken off to hospital. We discovered that all the residents had been listening to the rescue on shortwave radio because the owner of the hotel, Chris Briggs, used to be a mountain rescue organizer. His hotel, after all, was the base for the training of the Everest team. We got back there to, well, it wasn't thunderous applause, but it was a lot of interest because they'd all been listening to the rescue in progress. The rescue team had no time to receive thank you drinks. They were already out scouring the peaks for 3 more missing climbers. Anyway, John had been taken off to Bangor Hospital. David and Andrew and I felt we deserved several pints of beer and quite a few scotches, a meal and more scotches, only to be rung up at about 11 o'clock by Bangor Hospital, who said that the young man called John Tomicek was refusing to stay in hospital. I asked them about the x-rays, whether they'd x-rayed his head because of the injury to it. They had, no signs of damage, and his leg only had a hairline fracture. I thought, he's had a hell of a day anyway, and obviously wants to be with his friends. I told them, send him round to the Penygurith Hotel and I'll do a head chart on him. We can have him back to you in 20 minutes if anything goes wrong. This meant checking his pulse, pupils, blood pressure and breathing rate regularly. The next morning, the local police came round to the hotel wanting to see me and asked, who is this John Tomicek? What do you know about him? I told them the story of how I came to meet John and how he came to be with us. They then said, what would you say if we told you he's 14 years old and has been missing from home for 9 months? I said, I'd tell you exactly what I just have. That's what happened. If it had not been so, the word kidnapping would spring to mind, but I'd been trying to find out where his parents were, etc., etc. What had happened, of course, because of the routine police check-up on mountain rescue, was that they'd actually found out his home address, and his father was coming to collect him. He was a bit late in arriving. It's not far from Liverpool to the Penygurith, about a 2-hour drive, but his father took 5. I thought, if that was a son of mine, I'd have been there in a flash. But after I'd queried his delay with a raised eyebrow, John's father and I got on rather well. We both came to the conclusion that if he were taken back to Highton, Liverpool, he would only run away again. John's mother had died some 5 years ago, and his father had 4 other children to look after on his own. A proud man, understandably, he did not want institutional care for them. John had been asked to leave one rather strict Roman Catholic grammar school and was a persistent truant at another. We asked him, would you go back to school if you stayed in London? Yes, said John. So, informally, he became my ward and I his guardian. An odd feeling, suddenly becoming the parent of a teenager. All my paternal instincts emerged. Suddenly, it was exactly as if John were my son. Before returning to London, John went to stay with his father for a couple of weeks. We were going to Jersey to do some Python filming, and John arrived back in London in time to join me on that trip. I was very pleased to see him, and so was David. Our flat was his home. The local Nick, the Hampstead Nick, rang that very morning and said, "We'd like to have a talk to you, Dr. Chapman, about the John Tomicek business." I said, Oh, well, all right. Shall we come up to your place? No, I'll come up to the police station. Don't worry, I told them. As it happens, John's here at the moment. He's just arrived. Is he? Well, you'd better bring him too. John and I both went up to the police station. We had about 3 hours before catching the plane for Jersey, and we were kept there for two being questioned, John being rather more fiercely interrogated than I. After all, I was a doctor. A rather nervous Sergeant Green of the CID, the Hampstead Perverts branch, was questioning me. Eventually, he plucked up courage. There's one thing I do have to ask, Dr. Chapman, after a long pause. Are you a homosexual? I said, yes. He was expecting the more convenient answer, no. And then everything would have been all right. We would just have gone. But having had several articles published in which I stated that I was a homosexual, I didn't feel I could say no, and I couldn't honestly say no anyway. But obviously they had to check to make sure nothing was going on between John and myself. They then tried to get in contact with his father and eventually reached him by telephone and said to him, "I gather you've given permission for your son John to go to Jersey with Graham Chapman." His father said, "Yes, that's true." The police then said, "Did you know that Dr. Chapman was a homosexual?" And he said, "Yes." And then there was nothing they could do, much against their better judgment. We just caught our plane to Jersey. It may surprise the police, but I happen to believe, along with every homosexual that I've ever met, that it is antisocial and insensitive in the extreme for anyone of whatever sex to attempt to force any sort of physical attention on another person. John had found a stable, happy home and soon had a circle of friends at his new school. Apart from my being a bad influence in that my drinking habits encouraged him to drink too much, I think David and I have done a pretty good job, and we're proud of him.